at this point, the shepherd boy comes in.
Well, we actually, that had an interesting cut because it cut out the shepherd boy.
Oh.
With the music that happens now is the music of Cavaradossi entering. It's kind of,
oh,
and
okay.
it's the prelude to E luce van le stelle. But yeah, that's kind of an interesting recording because I thought, where's the shepherd?
Oh, okay, there we go. Well, poor shepherd boy, he got cut out.
Oh, wow.
It was an instrument. This was an instrumental version of a little bit of Puccini that we heard from a recording from the 1950s. My guest, Anthony Barese, who should know, is conducting this performance of Tosca. Welcome back, Anthony.
Thank you.
You were here, what, for Girl of the Golden West?
I was here for Barber of Seville.
Oh, that's right. Okay,
yeah.
And so back for this, these two performances, Friday night at 7:30, Sunday afternoon in Coeur d'Alene of Tosca. And right away with just what we heard, Puccini tells so many stories just with a few notes, doesn't he?
He really does. One of the criticisms that you often hear of Puccini is that, you know, people say that he got lazy towards the final acts. But I mean, what you just heard, that first horn entrance and the thing that was about to happen afterwards, the melody to E luce van le stelle, and then even the wonderful love duet that happens, this is all new music. I mean, he does recap some music from previous acts, but he's very good about also creating stuff really to the bitter end. And what you heard was a wonderful, it's just tone painting is a perfect way to describe it, because he's painting this, you know, 3 a.m. on the top of the Castello Sant'Angelo, and we're waiting for a man to come in who's about to die. It's 3 a.m. and you hear all those bells, and the extent to which Puccini explored the bells in Rome at the time is astonishing. There are letters from Puccini to this priest friend he had in Rome, and he said, look, I need to know this church and this position, what at 3 a.m, what's the pitch that their bell is? And then this other church, at that time in the morning, what pitch does that bell sound? And so he had all this information gathered, and he kind of mapped out all the churches in the vicinity of Castel Sant'Angelo, there are hundreds of churches, even just around St. Peter's, and he mapped it all out and kind of calculated this is what this would sound. To us, it's just sounds of pretty bells, but it's very calculated on his part, and it kind of goes by, but it's also, you know, really a wonderful effect.
Yeah. You know, the unfairest thing ever to say is to compare anything, but all of the great Puccini operas that we love, there are so many uniquely wonderful things to love about Tosca, aren't there?
Yeah, there really are. Just from the very beginning, you know, the first things you hear are the Scarpia chords, these very powerful, brash chords that are, you know, you don't even know what it is yet. You just hear this, like, very powerful statement. And then, you know, he's just really good about painting characters. The first act is very complicated because there's a lot of plot that you need to let the viewers know about. There's a lot of background, there's a lot of historical stuff. And for my money, it really starts cooking with gas in the second act. And I think the second act may be the greatest thing that Puccini ever wrote, because it's perfect. There's not one missed note. But he drives the drama forward in that second act in such a brutal and relentless way that I mean, everybody who doesn't know opera, I kind of think if you don't like Tosca, then you probably won't like opera. Mm-hmm. But if you've never been to an opera before, Tosca is a perfect opera, because it will really grip you. Definitely by the second act, most people are breathless with, you know, the way it kind of brings you in with the violence of the music and the forward momentum of the drama.
And the second act's the one that starts with the chorus singing in the church,
very shortly after the beginning of the second act, there you have an offstage chorus, and Tosca is singing along with them. Yeah.
Which did a couple things, I guess. I mean, it certainly set up that feeling of choral music and the church and the power of the church, and then it gives us a chance to hear Tosca in her role as
a singer. Yeah, it's kind of brilliant that way. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, you hear about, they talk about Tosca in the first act as a diva and she's a singer, but she's also, you know, if this opera, it's funny because if this opera takes place in the early 1800s, which is supposed, you know, which is when it's set, she wouldn't be singing Puccini.
Right.
She'd be singing Paisiello, she'd be singing Rossini, all these other things. But when it's set, it's in a very romantic, you know, era. And the only time we get any sense of what of the musical time period that she would have been in is in that cantata, mm-hmm. Which is in the style of a Pergolesi or a Paisiello.
Of the earlier Italian people. So putting this together into a performance. Now, well, let's talk a little bit about you and your history and what do you do? Do you conduct all over the everywhere?
I do. I conduct all over the everywhere. I've done 2 Toscas before. This is my 3rd time with it. It's a staple of the repertoire. It's a wonderful opera. And my job in a company like this is to kind of really bring it all together and encourage everyone to be the best that they can. All of 3 of our leads, the Cavaradossi, the Tosca, and the Scarabia, have done these roles numerous times. I think Jill Gardner, our Tosca, said that I think this is going to be like her 50th performance of this. So they've all done it quite a few times. And Tosca is an opera that's well known. So for me, the more well-known an opera is, the challenge becomes not so much in getting everyone to do. The challenge actually, in some ways, becomes getting people to what I call scrape off the barnacles, because a piece like this that is so well-known has a lot of historical baggage to it. I mean, there's recordings, there's Seraphine, and there's Callas, and there's Golbi, and there's all these famous, wonderful singers from the past who did it their way, who learned from other singers, and then we've learned it from them. And it's just, there's a lot of stuff that kind of becomes accepted historical knowledge as a piece continues in the repertoire. And I see my job more is filtering out the things that that make sense historically from those that have just become tradition because we get lazy.
And so that will all come together in the 2 performances, Friday night and Sunday afternoon. And had you worked with any of these singers before yourself?
I had not worked with any of the singers. Yeah. No.
And what are some of the places you have directed conducted in the last half year or so?
I've conducted at Sarasota Opera, Dallas Opera, Florida Grand Opera. I'm artistic director of a company in Albuquerque, New Mexico called Opera Southwest. I also have a small operetta company in Chicago called Chicago Folks Operetta. Those are the places that I've been the last couple of years.
So you have a suitcase and a baton.
I have, yeah. I really do. Yeah. And I have heavy scores that I carry everywhere.
Sure. What do you call home?
Chicago is my home. Yeah, Chicago is where I'm born and bred.
Okay, and then what about your training? Did it happen in that part of the world?
It's funny. There is no training program for opera conductors in any conservatory music school in the United States. Most people come to it playing rehearsal piano for an opera company. I came at it in a really roundabout way. I never studied conducting. All my training is in composition. And as a composer, you learn real quick that if you want to get your music done, you have to organize it. Mm. So you have to be a champion for your own music, and you have to have some skill in corralling people together and getting them to do what you want to do. So I had experience conducting my own music. And then after grad school, I got a scholarship to study in Italy for a while, and I meant to study composition, but the composer Luca Francesconi, who I was supposed to be studying with, his career was really taking off, so he didn't have a lot of time to dedicate to me. And at the same time, a small opera company in Milan was starting, a very small, like, you know, shoestring budget, you know, I think there were like 18 people in the orchestra, and they needed a conductor. And I knew somebody who knew somebody, and I was 24, and I had no idea what I was doing, and I had no fear. I was really naive, and I thought, like, how hard can this possibly be, you know? And I grew up listening to opera. My dad loves opera. I knew opera. So it was this fortuitous moment where my skills at, you know, kind of inspiring or manipulating people into doing, you know, musically what I wanted, and my knowledge of opera came together. And that was really the first, it was 1999, it was the first time I conducted an opera. It was La Boheme in Milan, and it was kind of, yeah. I have a tape of it at home that I haven't listened to, and it's gonna maybe like in the year 2019 I'll give it a listen just to kind of give some perspective how far I've come. But I just don't have the courage yet to to listen to it.
And with a name like Anthony Barese, do you speak Italian?
I do, yeah. I lived in Italy for a number of years, and I make it a point to continue studying the language. Yeah.
So that works. And what's an interesting opera that you're going to be doing after you, after this performance?
The next opera I will be doing will be in October in Albuquerque, New Mexico. First, we do a concert version of it in Baltimore, Maryland, and then we take it to Albuquerque, and we're doing Rossini's William Tell. Mm. Part of our mission in Albuquerque has been to do an extended series of Rossini works, the ones that people know, like Cenerentola and Barber Seville, but we've also done lesser known ones like Tancredi, like Turco in Italia, like his setting of Otello. So we've made a name for ourselves with some of the more obscure Rossini operas.
Mm-hmm. And you've made a name for yourself also with that genre of
yes.
opera, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So. The bel canto. But I love Puccini. I mean, Puccini, I would say Rossini and Puccini are my two favorite opera composers.
Yeah. And so Friday night, 7:30, Sunday at 2 at North Idaho College. So, you know, if you went down the street and got a cup of coffee and somebody asked you why they should go to this opera this weekend, what would be your over the cup of coffee speech to them?
My speech to them would be that if it's somebody who had never been to an opera, I would say that this unfolds, this kind of puts to rest all of the negative stereotypes that opera has. You know, long and boring. It's not long. It's very short. It's not boring. It's very exciting. It has wonderful melodies. It has a story that's gripping. It's very, you know, it's very violent. It's very gruesome. But it's also, it has a love story in it, a really passionate love story. So I think all the things that people are afraid of about opera, Tosca, you know, I wouldn't say that maybe they should see Handel's Giulio Cesare for their first time, because that might, you know, it might put him to sleep. But that's a very specific kind of opera. You know, it's like certain foods are real acquired tastes. And I think Tosca has an immediacy to it that is going to grip you, you know, right off the bat. That's why I would encourage people to come to it, simply because it's going to get you right away.
And as with all opera productions anymore, I assume there's super titles.
There are super titles. And that's a really good point, you know, because I meet people all over the country, smart, educated, doctors, lawyers, who have no idea that super that there's, you know, there are super titles. I mean, yes, we are performing it in Italian, but people think, oh, I don't want to go to the opera, I don't want to understand it. But you go there are super titles that have a clear translation. It's no more difficult than watching a foreign film on television. And you know, yes, you know, 30 years, 40 years ago, you had to, you know, read a translation and you had kind of no idea what was going on. But I do think that is a point that cannot be made too often, that we do have super titles in English, and that also adds to the immediacy of the work.
So it should be more than a little user-friendly Friday night.
Absolutely, yeah.
At 7:30, Sunday at 2 at North Idaho College. Conductor Anthony Barese, thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me.